You are listening to your Island Connection, Voice of Vashon, at 101.9 FM KVSHLP, Vashon Island, Washington.
Hello, and welcome to Stirring the Pot. I'm Linda Nygaard, and I'll be your host for the next 30 minutes. You're listening to the Voice of Vashon, and I hope you can pull up a chair and join us while we talk about all things food and culture. Thank you. Today, my guest is, I'm really excited about our show today. My guest is Kate O'Kane, and Kate is here for an encore appearance. Kate has been living a very exciting life. She's lived in lots of different places around the world. She's lived in China and Botswana and born and raised in the north of England, and she's traveled a lot. She's married to an ex-Marine pilot, whom we adore, and she has a wealth of information that she's going to share with us about her most recent trip to South Africa and Swaziland. Hi, Kate.
Hi, Linda. It's lovely to be back. Thank you.
I'm so glad that you're here. I'd like to take 1 second and get a couple, well, maybe more than 1 second, but get a couple business things out of the way.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I'd like to say thank you to those of you who emailed me last week. If you have ideas or questions, please email me at stirringthepot@voiceofvashon.org, and I will answer your email. Thank you so much for that. And secondly, I would like to put in a plug for the Voice of Vashon raffle. I don't know if you know or not, but you can win $2,000 worth of groceries. And it's $20 per ticket. You can get 5 tickets for $80. You'll see people in front of Thriftway and around town selling tickets. Buy some and get some $2,000 worth of groceries, if you can. You have to race. It's fun. Okay, here we are, Kate. So, Kate, you just recently returned from Swaziland, Botswana, in South Africa.
We did, yeah.
What were you doing there?
So we're very fortunate. We were able to go over and spend some time raising money for a charity called Young Heroes. It was set up by an American Peace Corps volunteer when he was there. And its main focus is on young kids and young people who, through whatever reason, whether they have the disease themselves or someone in their family, their lives are blighted in some way by HIV/AIDS. And so we went over, our primary purpose was to go over and raise money through doing a very long, very, very strenuous bike ride for 6 days.
How did all this come about?
So a great friend of mine, I have always worked in public health for the past sort of 10, 12 years. And a great friend from my days in public health is actually on the board. And so she had mentioned...
Of Young Heroes.
Okay. And so she had mentioned that she was going to be over there doing this. And my husband... who is training for an Ironman at the moment, was very excited about the idea of cycling. I was also excited about this, although I did not realize at the time quite how hilly, just like Vashon Island, Swaziland, or as it's now known, Eswatini, actually is. So it was more of a challenge for
was
me,
but
so glad we did it. We got an amazing opportunity to see the country, to meet people, and in my case, do a bit of exercise as well.
So what was the terrain like? What's it look like where you were bicycling?
It's fascinating because I thought it was going to be very much like Botswana where I'd lived before, a lot of very flat, red kind of dust. But no, it is an amazingly diverse country, almost in quadrants. You have an area that is sort of filled with sugarcane plantations, quite flat. As you're cycling through that, you're smelling the sugar and just wanting cake, basically. And then another quadrant is filled with amazing evergreens, very much like the Pacific Northwest. And that's quite hilly and quite mountainous.
Another area. Are these paved roads you're on?
Sometimes, but oftentimes it was more like mountain biking and a lot. I came off a few times. I still have bruises on my knees, but it was amazing. I learned a lot about cycling on the go. Another area is filled with citrus fruits. And at the age of 45, I discovered that pineapples are grown on the ground and not in trees, which I did not know until
then.
Was
it pineapple season when you were there?
It was. There wasn't any to eat, but they were all kind of like coming up and looking really quite amazing. So yeah, and another quadrant is desert. So it's a fascinating country from that perspective. But we were very lucky. We got to spend some time with the kids that are being supported by Young Heroes and really see the lives that they're living. And, you know, to see the way that they're living, especially in 2019 when the rest of us are kind of worrying about our Wi-Fi connection or, you know, who's cut us off at the four-way. spending time with these kids and realizing, you know, just how much we have was incredibly enriching.
You told me a story a couple of days ago about a little boy that was eating, and you know, do you want to talk about that a little bit?
His
meal of the day?
Yeah. And so, you know, a lot of these kids, they're either living with grandparents or with other families. And so they'll go each day to a kindergarten that's run by Young Heroes. And they'll have probably their only meal of the day there. And it sounds very Dickensian to talk about it, you know, in a kind of Oliver Twist kind of way.
Yeah.
But this one meal is literally gruel. It's a porridge that is created from maize. A lot of the times the maize comes from the World Food Programme. And, you know, it's just a watery porridge. And you see this maize meal all over Africa.
Mm-hmm.
I'll talk about it later, maybe when we talk about some of the more traditional meals of the region. But it's something that doesn't have much fortification in it.
Oh, I was going to ask if it was high protein or something.
It's not. There is a lot of work being done by, you know, various people, a lot of cereal companies to try and fortify it. So people like General Mills and others are trying to find ways to put nutrients in. But it's the one meal they get. And thank goodness they do. But there's certainly much more to be done.
Well, it sounds to me from a previous conversation we had that the kids are pretty happy as a rule down there. They're friendly and happy and open, and you had several little parades with you.
We did. I mean, they're kids, right?
Mm-hmm.
And thankfully, a lot of times they don't always understand what they don't have. So we would be cycling through these beautiful villages.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the vistas were stunning. And you'd get a sort of like little Pied Piper effect going on with these kids running behind you, often asking you if they wanted to race. And because of my cycling prowess, they would often beat me as well, which would cause immense joy that they had managed to beat the foreigner on her bicycle. But it was just delightful and fun and an amazing way to see a really beautiful country.
Yes, I can imagine. For those of you who haven't been there, I had to get out a map to find out exactly what we're talking about. And basically, we're talking about the southeast coast, kind of. But it's inland a little bit, correct?
It is. It's sort of, you've got Mozambique on one side and you've got South Africa on the other. And sort of surrounding it. It's actually the kingdom of Eswatini now. The king changed the name about a year and a half ago. It has very proudly been independent throughout.
Mm-hmm.
They managed to stave off attacks from the South Africans and the Zulus and the British and many other people.
You get to do that when you're in a monarchy like
indeed,
that.
Indeed.
You can pretty much say what you want to say.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think the other thing about Swaziland that's just interesting is how so much of traditions still stick there, and how the kingdom, you know, is so proudly still a monarchy, and it's quite unique for that part of the world.
And you still feel the influence from all of the different histories that have taken place there.
Different cultures coming. Yeah. So whilst we were there, we actually went to a festival where there were young men and young women very proudly still doing their traditional dancing and cooking traditional food. And, you know, I think, and one of the things that Swaziland is famous for is the king having many wives and there being various parties that happen during the year and events and traditional festivals, which often involve the women being topless. If you were to do that, I think in the US, where breastfeeding is seen as such a problem, it would have issues. But there was no kind of like snarky comments or silliness with it. It was very much a proud tradition that the people of Swaziland still want to engage in.
Yeah. And there you are on your bicycle, and I would imagine riding through some rather hot days,
It was very hot. It was like 80 to 90 every day. And quite, humid, so it was a little bit sweaty, it has to be said.
So at the end of the day,
I was starving, Linda.
And so tell me, but before we get to the food, let's talk about the libation. They have a new industry down there for...
They do. And it's so exciting to me because I love a good gin and tonic. And so Swaziland has now got its own gin distillery. It's called Imbali and it's based on a London dry gin. It has the infusions of local spices, indigenous spices, and citrus as well.
So the indigenous spices would be?
I'm not sure. It didn't say on the bottle, which I brought back with me, but I'm imagining there's going to be things like a little bit of nutmeg, a little bit of cayenne, a little bit of aromatic spices going on in there as well. But we were very lucky. Every evening when we came in, Steve, who's the founder of Young Heroes, would always have a gin and tonic ready for us.
Oh, nice.
Usually with a nachi, which is like a little orange that had come from the trees above us as
The gin and tonic?
In the gin and tonic, yeah. Kind of almost like a, I guess almost like a grapefruity kind of taste to it, which was which was beautiful. The other thing that you can always get down there as well is a really good Pilsner beer. You've got a lot of old German breweries that were in the area, and so some cold beers are always available as well.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the influences, the different influences that are there in their cuisine. Would you like to address that a little bit?
Sure, yeah. I mean, that's what's so fascinating about the region. And, you know, I want to preset this with the fact that I am not from the region. And so every time I've been, it's been a new adventure for me and new experiences. But one of the fascinating things is just where everybody has come from in the region. So obviously there were people who were there, first of all, the indigenous people who have lived there and come from there. But then others had come in through either their own volition or through, unfortunately, slavery. And with them, everybody, whether they are immigrants or forced migration, has brought with them their spices, their tales, their cuisines, and their cultures. And so you've just got this amazing hodgepodge of so many different things being brought together.
Well, it seems that the Dutch had a great influence early as the 1600s. And that was the beginning of the slave trade.
That's my understanding.
It's my understanding of it. I'm not a historian either, you know, but I did, I have read, and I do think that that, you know, what I've read is true. And that that began some of the different spices and origins of different foods, because it came from, the slaves came from Malaysia and from India. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah. And so you have a whole group of people that have become known as the Cape Malays.
Okay.
And so with them, I think Indonesia, Malaysia, and India brought with them some of the spices. But even if they couldn't find the spices that they were used to in their homes, they were looking for alternatives. And so some of the really famous sort of Southern African dishes, so bobotie, that we may speak about soon, involve a lot of curried spices, paprikas, cayennes as well. And then you've also got the folks who are over in Mozambique as well. And so a lot of the peri-peri taste that we get from Nando's now, that's Portuguese chicken that was coming a lot over from the Mozambican areas as well.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And then on top of that, you have this sort of, this grouping of both German and Dutch settlers that have come in. And with them, they've brought some very traditional sort of, I guess, Northern European recipes as well. So it all comes together and it just provides such an interesting mix.
Well, part of it was, well, obviously it's original farm to table. Like, we talked about that too. And the interesting thing to me is that if they didn't have the correct spice, if they didn't have the right ingredient, they found something. And so from that, inventiveness, I guess, and passion toward serving good food came brand new dishes.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the most fascinating is the bunny chow, which is
the bunny chow.
So bizarre to me, but I just think is amazing in its story, where when Indian settlers had come over, they were working in the mines around Durban, which is on the East Coast. They wanted to take their curry to work with them, and they couldn't get the right flour for their rotis. So instead, what they did is they went and bought a cheap loaf of white bread, which the Dutch and other settlers had created and were doing in their usual bakeries. And they would go, they'd scoop out the inside of the loaf.
So they have a loaf that's not sliced.
It's just basically scoop it out. And they'd scoop out the center. They'd put their vegetable curry in and then they'd put the other crust back on the top. And then off you'd go to work with your very handy little box of bread.
Does that remind you of anything?
Well, it reminded me of the Cornish pasties
and how
basically kind of like the miners used to have those to hold so they would be able to eat their food. So,
while they work.
Indeed. So it's kind of fascinating how we adapt, we overcome. Gosh, I'm starting to sound like my husband who's a Marine, and that's the adapt and overcome. But
well, we have to now.
Yeah, we do. So
we're all adapting and overcoming, I think. So I think we're going to take a little break right now, and we'll be right back with Cato Kane.
VOV programming support is provided by Northwest School of Animal Massage. They have something for every animal lover. Workshops, professional courses, and blended learning options as students learn large and small animal massage for professional certification or to take special care of beloved pets. Learn more at nwsam.com.
Can't do what we do on Voice of Vashon without our underwriters, like Snapdragon Bakery and Cafe. Pastries in the morning, vegetarian lunches, wine and music at night fill the friendly, casual atmosphere that is Snapdragon on Vashon Highway at the south end of town. On the web at vashonsnapdragon.com.
Hello, you're listening to The Voice of Vashon. I'm Linda Nygaard at Stirring the Pot, and we're here talking with Kate O'Kane. So, Kate, we've been talking about South Africa and Swaziland, which is now Eswatini.
Eswatini, yeah.
Which is Eswatini.
That's correct.
Eswatini.
Yeah.
It's a really interesting name. And we've been talking about food from down there. And one of the national dishes is a dish called boboti.
Boboti.
Yeah. Tell me about boboti.
Well, it's just one of those really heartening, warming kind of dishes. Mm-hmm. When I was knew I was going to come and talk to you, I asked a lot of South African and Southern African friends what are the, sort of the big dishes that they remember. Mm-hmm. And this is one of those ones that is just a family favorite. It's to me, it always reminded me a little bit of shepherd's pie or moussaka or something like that.
It's a casserole.
It's essentially minced beef or minced lamb with all the infusion of those spices that we were just talking about. And again, it's a Cape Malay dish. So it came from that community of slaves from Indonesia and Malaysia. And oftentimes those women were making food for the families in which they were living. And so it became much more infused into the wider Southern African network as well. But it's essentially this minced beef with all of these spices in it. And then it has an egg kind of dressing on the top with some bay leaves in it. And it's just beautiful. I mean, I was, thinking about it and thinking it wouldn't be perfect for an American summer, but with the weather today, maybe it would be today.
Yeah. Well, it's my understanding that the bay leaf is really an important ingredient in this particular dish.
It seems to be. It seems to be something that you really need to infuse both into the meat, but then also make sure you've got on the top as well so that it seeps into the eggy kind of crust to it as well.
Well, we'll have a recipe for boboti on the line when we get there.
We will
there.
Do, yeah.
Yeah, we will. I mean, we don't have one right this minute, but we'll have one.
We have also the option of making it as well, Linda, and then you can tell everybody what you think of it, which we need to do sometime.
We should do that. It has an interesting history, too, in that it wasn't always readily available out in the marketplaces and in restaurants because it was seen as sort of less than food?
Because I guess it came from what would have been seen as slave population, it probably had noses turned up at it.
It wasn't shishi enough.
And yet, actually, fantastically, it has become the national dish of the country. So I think that shows how important the sort of intermingling of different cultures and different elements has become.
Because what happened was people would go into the ghettos and into the old neighborhoods to find it and just go to someone's house.
And isn't that just the way whenever any of us travel is actually going and finding the best food
finding
is
the
usually
places.
In the little, hole in the wall restaurants that nobody else really knows about.
But it was, it was thought of as, it's easy to find now. As a matter of fact, I read that in 2014, Epcot at their food and wine festival had boboti because it's an international food and wine festival. But they listed it as gluten-free, which I don't know how it can be gluten-free, but it's not.
It's supposed to have bread in it, but maybe there's a way.
Well, those Americans, you know how they are.
There's evidently supposedly one of the best recipes from my South African friend in D.C. told me is in the New York Times.
Really?
I've always used the BBC Good Food recipe, but the New York Times one is also supposed to be good if people want to look it up themselves.
Well, we have to have a date and do that. The other thing, another thing I want to talk about is some of the side dishes they have, and just because I love to say the word and I really want to eat some, let's talk about chakalaka.
Chakalaka. I know you just want to dance to the name of it. Chakalaka was one of those things that actually made for me a lot of Southern African food really have a bit of a zing to it.
Okay.
A lot of food, certainly in Botswana, didn't have some of the spices. The spices didn't always get into the cooking as far as Botswana. And so chakalaka is a tomato and bean relish with a lot of spices, cayenne, paprika, nutmeg, and basically peppers in it that you would have on the side of your meat and your veg and your starch.
Okay, so here's the difference. In my mind, because I'm an American, I'm thinking of green beans. And maybe not.
No.
In your mind, or I was thinking of maybe it's a white bean, kind of navy bean thing, but it's a what?
Well, it's actually a baked bean.
Yeah, baked beans.
I mean, I don't know if it was originally, but certainly these days, every recipe that I've seen and certainly when I've made it with friends has had baked beans in it.
I'd like to try it sometime. And is it along the lines in spiciness as Mrs. Ball's?
Mrs. Ball's is probably a smoother kind of spice. So this is almost like the HP sauce or pickle.
Okay.
So Mrs. Ball's is the Branston pickle of Southern Africa. Chakalaka is much more vibrant. But again, it's one of those things you can choose yourself how much you want to spice it up. It's up to you how much cayenne and paprika you put in it.
When you are eating there, is it the traditional methods of eating? How's the etiquette? What does that feel like?
It's very similar to, you know, to life as I know it in terms of eating. A lot of these cultures have been influenced by European kind of manners and gentility of eating together. So sitting down at a meal, I often think that when I'm in Southern Africa, we have in some ways gone back to sort of like 1950s, 1960s England, where people stand and round a table and wait for everyone to sit down together. Or, you know, you will stop a meeting to have tea and a fat cake together. So it's more of that kind of mentality of good kind of manners, as my mother would like to say. But then, you know, as with everywhere, there is the culture of fast food. You know, so there's a lot of fried chicken that you can get in places. And then there's also just people are busy. You know, people have busy lives and hard lives, and they're doing a lot of different jobs. And so there's a lot of street food culture as well.
Well, there's a lot of, like we would call barbecue. They do their meat that way.
They do meat, but, all the you know, time. As you're and driving vegetables. Through, absolutely. As you're driving through just a longer road, you will see a lot of people standing with a little grill. And what I mean by that is essentially a metal box filled with coals or wood. And they will be standing over it with a piece of cardboard to waft it and make sure that it's going. And you'll have on that corn or you'll have chicken. And to be honest, chicken is really seen as a vegetable in Southern Africa. If it's not red meat, it's not a meat. So chicken is a vegetable, often covered with a sort of a spicy red peri-peri kind of sauce. And so a kid coming home from school might buy some corn to eat, or they might buy chicken leg, and that will be their snack for the way home.
And is their corn... they have multicolored corn as well as blue and yellow and white. And they have the whole gamut of corn.
All the different corns that we would have here now. And some of the ones that, you know, you'll see in Whole Foods that are kind of like the fancy corns.
Yeah, the fancy ones.
Will be the ones that are just normal over there.
And you told me that you had one of the best ears of corn you've ever had in your life.
Delicious.
Just right by the side of the road.
Yeah, we were actually very lucky. And I probably will never be able to see corn again without thinking of one of the girls who was doing the bike ride with us. She was from Kenya. And every time we'd finish for the day, she needed corn. So the hunt would be on in the car back to wherever we were staying to find some corn.
And you would find it.
We would.
Yes. So we've moved through the meal now and we're going to have dessert.
Yes.
So there's something special called malva.
I love this. This is one of, this to me, and I think it goes back to the nostalgia that food brings for any of us. But this reminds me of the sort of the sponge puddings that we would have as a kid after Sunday lunch. So malva pudding is a sponge pudding. It has apricot jam, usually steamed around it, and you would serve it with custard or cream or ice cream. And it's just one of those heartening, saucy, kind of like sweet, delicious things that really just finishes off the meal well.
Is it a spongy, juicy?
It's not soft. I mean, it's got a certain consistency to it of hardness, but it does melt in your mouth once it's in there, and it's absolutely delicious. And you know, I wish there was a place here that would do it. Maybe I need to come.
Well, maybe we need to make some.
Yeah, maybe we need to make that as well. A South African feast.
And so there are also things similar to custard tarts that you like as
milk
well.
Tarts. So they're very similar to the ones you'd see for like Portuguese custard tarts or potentially the Chinese egg tarts as well. And it's interesting how when you travel around and you see a dish somewhere and you're like, well, that looks like this and like this.
Right.
And you realize just how communities have spread around the world. I was reading about another dessert, which is the peppermint crisp tart. And the recipe I was looking at for that was actually a woman who's living in London now, South African, living there and trying to get the right ingredients to make it.
But you would think it wouldn't be. It's Nestle chocolate.
Nestle chocolate only does peppermint crisp, as far as I can tell. This special kind of chocolate in South Africa.
Isn't that interesting?
Why South Africans all over the world are desperate to get hold of peppermint crisp. I think you can probably buy it in a specialist store somewhere.
Maybe.
Just like Australians want their Tim Tams and you know, Brits want their Garibaldi biscuits and things like that.
Right.
There are different things that sort of are the taste of home, I guess.
And then cooking utensils are an interesting item as well.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about what you discovered when you were there.
So, I mean, this is something that I'd seen many times when I'd been at sort of traditional dinners and things like that in Botswana, but it's known as a potje. And essentially it looks like a cauldron. So
can you spell that for me?
P-O-T-J-I-E.
Potje.
Potje. Okay. And there are particular dishes that you'd make, but it's a big stewing cauldron actually. And it has the three little legs underneath it.
So you put it right on the fire.
Right into the fire.
Okay.
And so if you're making the seswar in Botswana, or you're making ugali, which is the big, the maize starch, that's what it's going to be made into, straight over the fire. And it kind of takes you back to a sort of like Macbeth kind of like feeling of this cauldron and stirring things. But it's an incredibly important part of a kitchen.
I would love to see that. I would just love to see that. Let's talk about water down there and how, what sort of realization you came to when you came home. And
well, it's funny because I think you kind of, when you travel to places, you know, and I was watching a comedy show last night about don't use the ice and don't have the water and things like that. It's very easy just to, especially with the conversations we have now about plastic bottles, to forget the resource of water in terms of it coming out of a tap somewhere. And everywhere that we went, you know, water was incredibly important. I was literally sweating, needed water to stay sustained.
You have to rehydrate.
Absolutely. But water is not it's not an easy thing to get to, especially in some of these villages where the school was that we went to. The tap hadn't been fixed for 3 or 4 months. They'd asked people to come. There's one central tap that the kids
for
and the school
for the whole village.
For the whole village. And so, well, for this bit of the
for
village.
That, yeah.
And then the other one was on the other side, so about a mile away. And so to get water to make the gruel or the porridge that we were talking about earlier, one of the women and some of the kids would have had to walk a mile to go and get that water. And it just makes you realize when, I mean, you know, silly things like the water that we flush our toilets with is actually often cleaner and of course much more accessible to us than the water that people need to live, drink and eat from. So I think a trip like this, you know, without starting to sound all kind of like, you know, better than anybody else, a trip like this, and I am as bad as anybody else, makes you really think again about, you know, how do I use water? What are, you know, the restraints I put on myself from wasting it? What do I do with my food waste as well?
Right.
You know, and I think we certainly in the Northern Hemisphere are pretty terrible about food waste. So what could we be doing better with our food waste?
And that is a whole other show.
Absolutely.
And it's something we're working on right now. So maybe you'll come and talk with us about that as well.
Love to.
But the water issue is big. And I think, you know, water is going to be the next gold. And we're in the middle of it. And I think especially here on the Northwest, we don't really, it rains all the time, you know, so we don't.
We're surrounded by water.
Right.
We've got water going underneath us.
I do think about it and I'm better, but I feel really badly when I think about the kids walking a mile in the heat just for water.
Yeah. I think, you know, just there's so many things we can do to make things a little bit easier, even though it doesn't feel as though there's a necessity here.
Right.
You know, not having your faucet on when you're brushing your teeth.
I know. That took a while for me to learn, but I learned it. I did it.
Not flushing the loo because you don't like the color of the water you're about to pee in.
Well,
those little things.
I'm not going there. So I have had a really good time talking with you today, and there's so much more to learn. I do have a couple of personal questions I want to ask you, though.
Oh, goodness.
What's in your fridge right now that might surprise people?
What's in my fridge right now? You know, there's a lot of fruit because we're both trying to be very healthy at the moment.
Good. So, well, he's training for Ironman.
Yeah. So we're actually, I'd say our fridge is looking pretty good at the moment.
Wow.
I'd be quite happy for someone to come around and look at that.
Good.
But I always have some, I don't know what they're called here. Pickled herring roll mops in a sort of a cream sauce.
I always have pickled herring in my fridge.
Yeah,
too.
which comes from my German grandmother. That we always used to have that when I went to Germany.
Yeah.
So that's kind of like the weird thing that my husband looks on disdainfully.
And he doesn't eat it?
Oh, he does not eat that, no.
Does he have any interesting article in the fridge?
I probably shouldn't discuss his eating habits because we talk about that at length at home on a regular basis. So. No, is the simple answer to that one.
No secrets out of school. What's your favorite kitchen tool? What do you like to use?
Well, you know, you gave me that new spoon yesterday, Linda.
Yes.
So that's already been used.
Oh, good. I'm so glad.
What do I like to use? You know, I'm actually just a lover of big bowls. I like having enough bowls to be able to mix or prepare things in.
And they're pretty, too.
Yeah, I like that.
I like bowls, too. Well, Kate, thank you so much for coming. I want to get one more factoid in here. Uh-oh. How much money did you guys raise down there? There were six of you that went.
There were six of us. We raised $6,500. Overall, we raised $100,000.
I'm so proud of you. Thank you for the work you're doing.
Well, thank you.
And thank you for listening to Stirring the Pot on Voice of Vashon. I'm Linda Nygaard, and I'll see you next week. Bye.